Today, more from the property market front line with Chris Bates. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, welcome to the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined by Chris Bates, mortgage broker and whiz about property. Hi, Chris.
G'day, Martin. How are you doing?
Pretty good. We spoke at the end of May and the property market's turned into a lemon.
Yeah, I mean, there's always one market you can, you know, say that. I mean, ANZ, I think it was all over the AFR yesterday, Melbourne's going to fall 20%. It was an annualized rate of 1.4%. So it was a great headline. But yeah, I mean, there's lots to it, isn't there? I mean, it's the global economy is the big risk, right? So we, you know, we have no idea how that's going to play out. Is it going to be we get through to the end of 2020 and then this big tidal wave hits us in 2021? Or does a vaccine come out and do we somehow have a slow recovery? That's the big unknown and the big risk, really.
Yeah, and I think that's the point, isn't it? There are lots of local factors that we can explore, but until we actually understand what's happening with COVID globally as well as locally and the broader economic outfall of that, pretty much everything else is a pale shadow because, you know, if in fact this rages on and, you know, economies around the world continue to buckle under its force, whatever we do locally here, it's not going to make much difference, is it?
Yeah, I think we're trying to do everything we can to keep the party going, which every, you know, PM or president is trying to do all over the world and doing that since, what, 2008, right? So every time the economy's going to slow down or construction's going to slow down, then we do something to kind of keep kicking the can down the road. The problem is there a D-Day that it all hits and, you know, we do go into this big global recession. The governments can't kind of, you know, save us, really. And that's the big unknown. I think if there is a vaccine, if, you know, the economy start opening up, does the, you know, unemployment numbers start dropping again? Do we start to go back to some form of normality? And can we kick that can down the road further? And that's the big unknown, which, I, you know, obviously we don't know.
Well, that's right. But I guess there are two issues. One is unemployment. You know, the RBA came out yesterday and said it's likely to be 10%. So that's higher than previously because of what's happening in Melbourne. And the problem with unemployment is it takes a long time generally to come back down again. So I keep saying you tend to go down the escalator, but you have to go up the stairs. And so it can take 2 or 3 years sometimes for that. The second is, of course, migration. Migration is pretty much zero now because of the international flight bans. And that means that one of the key levers in terms of propping up property in Australia was migration. That's pretty much turned off. So the population growth is much slower now ahead than previously. So those, to me, are the two leading indicators. And I do recognise, of course, that people keep calling, you know, the doom and gloom, you know, Steve Keen and Harry Dent and everybody else, right? So there are lots of balancing items in the conversation, which is important to understand. I have a feeling that, you know, some of the leading indicators that I'm seeing, particularly unemployment and migration, are suggesting that this time it's going to be tough unless we can actually turn that around relatively quickly.
Yeah, I mean, migration does support a massive construction industry, which is a big part of the economy. When you buy a new house, you furnish it, you've got stamp duty, all the state government money they make on the new builds, foreign students, you know, them family, tourism, etc. So, you know, Australia without doubt needs an economy that's completely open and people moving here and bringing money here. And so if that doesn't happen, then we're going to really struggle. I agree with you as well. Like, I think if we get to, you know, 10, 15% unemployment, but then it starts to bounce back quite strongly and it starts to get back to 6, 7, you know, percent and starts to go back to where it was, you know, things will be okay. But, you know, like, you know, that unemployment, you don't just go get a job. You need confidence to come back to start hiring. Does our participation rate drop? Do people just, you know, get part-time jobs? You know, it doesn't just come back. And my big learning was when I was in the UK watching going through the recession there, just seeing how many years it took for businesses to start opening up again and to start hiring.
Yeah, if you look at the the global financial crisis, which is a bit of an analog. You know, it took 4 or 5 years for that to shake out. So property prices fell for 4 years. Businesses started collapsing after 2 years, and it took 5 or 6 years for the thing to go the other way. And that was with massive central bank support right the way through. So this is going to be potentially a long road. But talking about government support, you know, we should touch on JobKeeper, JobSeeker, and the business support, because clearly that stimulus so far has been quite significant. I guess my question is, what's going to happen to that? Because if you look at the forward numbers from Treasury so far, they're withdrawing that support. My own view is it's probably too soon.
Yeah, and it's so much money, right? Like, you're talking, even just the super thing, that I've never been a fan of allowing people to get access to 10 grand out of their super. As soon as I heard the policy, I was like, it's not going to end well, this, because, you know, some people are going to really need it and they're going to spend it on necessities, and some people are going to take that money because it's an opportunity and they're going to spend it on things like online gambling's gone through the roof and, you know, lots of other things. And, you know, that has been about, what is it, $30 billion or something has come out, and a lot of that's gone into the economy. You know, even just the business, 100 grand, the home builder that's come out, that's, you know, the Liberal Party were kind of bragging last week just how effective that policy was and how much it stimulated people going buying new properties. And obviously I say that tongue in cheek, because it's not a great result for the consumer spending that money and buying a new property to support the construction industry. But from their point of view, it did what they wanted to do. It got people to go on basically, you know, buy homes, really. So it's huge amount of stimulus. The big issue is that, do the business survive when all this money dries up? And, you know, have we got all these zombie companies that are just, you know, taking the JobKeeper and taking all the benefits just to get through, and on the other side, there's no business and no jobs?
Yeah, and my surveys, my business surveys, suggest about 1/3 of businesses are very much under the pump at the moment, and many of them have not accessed the JobKeeper scheme. Now, of course, the extended period of decline in terms of business momentum is really forcing them to think very hard about whether they are going to be able to continue or not. So there are significant risks to small business. And of course, many small business people are actually leveraged by way of their property. So in fact, the business is supported by a mortgage on a property. And so that's another factor that many people haven't quite woken up to yet. You know, everyone's talking about the you know, consumer land, but the small business sector, which is, what, 2 or 3 million, depending on how you measure it, a significant proportion of those, I think, are going to be in some difficulty ahead as well. And so my worry is you've got all of these feedback loops, and if you draw a line between somebody who's paying rent because they've got a part-time job, you know, in a restaurant yeah. somewhere, right, that rent goes to a property investor who essentially is reliant on the rent to be able to pay the mortgage. So suddenly that mortgage payment stops, and that property investor has already seen the capital reduce in their mortgage, but they were also relying on that payment not only to pay their mortgage, but also to cover some of the cost of living. So suddenly they're under pressure, and you know, at the end of the chain, they may have another mortgage too on a property they're still living in, and suddenly that gets under pressure. So the problem is, you join all the dots, and you can see that at every point there is a pinch point. And of course, it's like a cascading set of dominoes. So it's really tough to work out how to sort of stop the whole thing just falling over.
Yeah, you're right. Like the say 90% of people are still employed, right? If you go with the just simple numbers, right? But that doesn't mean that they're all okay, you know, because they've got a job. Then they could be future. They could lose their job because, you know, they might not have lost their, you know, that's definitely something that happens in recessions. You know, cutbacks might not be immediate, but they can come down the line. So there's all that potential future unemployment. There might be no wage growth there for them, no bonus. And so they're getting affected. But then they also might have, like you say, most investors haven't known or haven't really have got great advice when they've gone and bought investment properties. You know, they've read a magazine, they've spoken to an accountant who's referred them to a new property. You know, they've gone for a tax break and they've bought, you know, an apartment, and they just haven't really done a great job. And so a lot of them have potentially got assets right now that are under a bit of pressure. You know, they've got very high vacancy rates, they haven't got tenants, rents are getting cut, capital falls. And so, yeah, got a job, but that doesn't mean everything's rosy. And, you know, one potential bad investment property, they might have bought something in Darwin or Perth or et cetera, you know, that loss just sits there and, you know, it can really eat into their monthly cash flow because, you know, they haven't got a tenant or, you know, or even just the costs are just too high.
Yeah, well, I'm seeing that. I survey, as you know, households, and I've developed my mortgage stress analysis to look specifically at the property investment sector, because you've got to look at it differently, right? So I'm looking now at where they live rather than where they've got property investment properties, because they've got them all over the place, which is the first point. And the second is I have to measure it differently. So I look at things like vacancy. Is the property vacant? Are they trying to sell the property? Are they underwater on a cash flow basis? And other factors too. And on that basis, 25% of property investors are actually judged on my modeling as stressed. 25%, right? And what's interesting, that about half of them, of that 25%, are now saying, well, maybe I should be considering exiting from the investment property sector over the next few months. And in fact, of course, the issue is that if you think prices are going to go down, then you probably want to do it soon. In fact, I was chatting with a couple of property investors this morning who basically said, we think it's time to get out. You know, we've got a bit of equity in our property at the moment. We can't see that growing. Our rental is under pressure. We can't make the economics work. And they did some calculations and using a couple of different calculators, and they realized that on a cash flow basis, they were losing money every week. So no capital growth, losing money. They've decided to cut their losses. I'm getting that story quite often these days.
Yeah, I think that people believe that property investors are probably a big part of the market, and they are. But, you know, there's, say, 14 million taxpayers, but there's probably only about two to two and a half million property investors, you know, and probably one and a half roughly of those have got one property. And then you've got roughly a million that have got maybe two, three, four, five, six. I think the ones who have got potentially one property, you know, there's something called loss aversion, which we all feel, whether we've got $1,000 of shares or we've, you know, bought something for $100, no one wants to lose money, right? So especially on a big transaction like a property. So most investors will just try to hold on because they don't want to crystallize that loss. But the people who can't afford to do that are the people who have got three, four, five properties. Yep. And, you know, the cash flow is not there. They haven't got the job, no tenants. They're the ones I'm really worried about. But, you know, we are talking a small number of people. And, you know, what they'll probably do is they'll look at their portfolio and go either sell their best one to get a lot of cash, which may have gone up, or potentially just try to sell their worst ones. And so they won't just go and sell all five or six. They'll just try to keep the party going. So you're right. I think but most property investors have gone and bought poor assets. They've either gone for a quantity strategy. They've gone and bought six $300,000 properties, or like cheaper properties, because they believe that the amount you spend determines your risk, not the quality of the property. Or they've gone and bought something new, a house and land package, a new townhouse, duplex, Southeast Queensland, or a new apartment. And so those markets are where you're going to protect. And that's where a lot of other investors have gone. So that's where you'll see, lots of supply come on. And those markets have already got lots of supply. So that's where you'll see the investor problem play out, more so than the home buyer market, which drives most of the market.
Yeah, well, just on the investment side, the most stressed segments from the investment are actually young affluents and exclusive professionals. And the characteristic of both of those is multiple investment properties. Mm. So you're spot on in that analysis, whereas down the list, you know, people with one property will probably more likely hang on. And interestingly, of course, young affluents have tended to buy more recently because they tend to, by definition, be, you know, in the market more recently. So they've already seen the prices do some of this, so they're already losing equity, whereas those who bought a long time ago, again, are sitting on quite a sizable equity pile, and so they can afford to let the property drops a bit if, in fact, they can continue to let it. The trick question here, of course, is what will happen to rentals, because, in fact, rentals have dropped significantly. I noticed that in Hobart, for example, it's dropped dramatically. In Sydney and Melbourne, it's dropped as well. And interestingly, there's a correlation between rental stress and investor stress. Like Melbourne 3000 is actually, in my surveys, the postcode with the highest degree of rental stress in terms of the count of people and the largest count of investors who are actually stressed. So there is a horrible correlation there as I see all of this begin to play out. So again, I think it's important to get granular and to understand, you know, how the dynamics work. But you're also right that two-thirds of the market are owner-occupiers, And most of those people are actually borrowing because they've got somewhere to live. And of course, they're going to try and hang on for that as best they can. And to that end, I suppose some of them will have perhaps reached for the interest and capital repayment holidays to be able to try and get through.
Yeah, so your Melbourne 3000 there, which you've kind of mentioned, is a prime area where most of those will be investors, and they might even be foreign investors, and they've bought high-rise apartments. And so that market, you know, is going to potentially have lots of supply, very little demand. And so not a great thing to be owning right now. So, and if I was an investor owning that, or Docklands or South Bank, or even really most apartments in Melbourne and Brisbane per se, have really struggled. And so those properties, without doubt, they're in trouble. And you've got building issues in Sydney as well, and et cetera. Like you say, around the owner-occupier thing, is if most people are looking at the housing market and they're wanting to get into the housing market, or they're just, that's why they're watching the channel, for example, that's a completely different market. And the best thing, the thing to be worried about here is the payment holidays. And, you know, it's a big number when you talk about billions and billions of dollars. It seems like a massive number, but what you have to do is you have to get a bit of perspective and say, what does that really mean? Like, how many people are actually using the payment holidays? Where are they? Are they using it because they have to use it, or are they using it because they could use it, you know? And once you start doing that and you cut up the data, I personally don't think the risk there is as big as, you know, it seems when you look at that headline figure, because you can start to cut it up. The interesting thing with the payment holidays is it's going to end at some point. It's probably going to end in September, October for most people. And to get the additional 3 months, it was a tick-the-box exercise. Banks didn't have the firepower to go through every client and say, yes, we're going to give you the extension or not. It was, do you want it? Yes. Okay, we'll give it to you. But the additional 4 months won't be like that. And it'll actually be an opportunity for the bank and the customer, the mortgagee, to basically have a discussion on what's the solution here. Is it, you know, let's wait for another job in the next 4 months? Have you got other buffers? Can we extend your loan term? Can we go interest only? Can you potentially rent the property out? Look, it's in the bank's interest to come up with a solution with the borrower to not have to sell that property. And so that's what that 4 months is going to be. And then at the end of the 4 months, the banks are going to basically say, look, you know, this is it, we can't see an out here for you. You know, then we'll start going down arrears proceeding. But if that property is a good property, they've got a good asset, they've got lots of equity in the property, then, you know, and they haven't got a job and they can't refinance, et cetera, they'll explore all their options because they know they're good, a good asset. But absolute worst case, if they do hit the market, it's not going to be this sort of fire sale, you know, example, because it's a good asset, for example. But the problem is if they've got a poor asset, and whether you're going to start seeing problems is banks are not going to want to go into areas where there's already lots of LVR issues. So new house and land packages, for example, most people have bought them in recent years with high debt. There's very limited capital growth, potential capital falls. And that area, a bank will be looking at that property and saying, look, I don't want this to get any worse. And so they're going to potentially put more pressure on that type of property owner to sell than if it's an asset in a good suburb where they're going, well, we have no real risk of this property going down in value. We don't have to get you off the books because it's not really a risk to us. Whereas those new house and land packages, I think that's where you're going to start to see the banks get really nervous.
I agree with that. And that's correlating with my mortgage stress data, which shows that a lot of stress is in the outlying urban fringe where people bought relatively recently, land, house package, big mortgage, you know, a very high loan to value ratio. And by the way, on relatively higher incomes than perhaps you might expect.
Yeah.
But the incomes now have got crushed, and their ability to be able to service those mortgages are pretty horrendous. And the numbers, just the sheer numbers of households in places like Cranbourne in Victoria, or, you know, Campbelltown, or you know, around Liverpool way, makes it hugely risky for banks to do anything other than put a lot of pressure on to try and get people to you know, step up and sell, hopefully with a bit of equity and, you know, repay the mortgage. Whereas closer into town, where the stress numbers are somewhat different, and the future trajectory probably of property means that you might have a different conversation. So I'm seeing that in some of the data, and I'm even seeing it in some of the reported conversations that I'm getting from some of my followers, because it looks to me as though they are already getting a lot of pressure from some lenders in some locations, particularly the high-stressed ones, whereas some of the other people in other locations seem to be having a much more open conversation, and there seem to be many more options on the table.
Yeah, I mean, it's the loan book to the bank, right? They're going to cut that loan book up and say, how do we protect our risk, really? And where are we potentially going to get losses? And let's try to one by one get them off their payment holiday, or get them, and let's focus on them. And not the other ones, let's just come up. Let's make sure we're doing everything right for responsible lending and things like that. But you're right. And I think that's the real worry is once the, if you start to get fire sales, and it's like, if you think those problems are going to happen, don't wait for the payment holidays to finish. Don't wait to, you know, you get the 4 month arrears. You're going to start to see some fire sales on the market, and you don't want to be selling when everyone else is fire sales, because if the property up the road, you know, let's say it should go for $1 million, that sells for 900 under a stress scenario. Well, everyone believes that that suburb's only 900,000 now because of that sale. So if you're in that position, you want to be dealing with it today, not in, you know, when everyone else is dealing with it down the line.
Right. And one of the questions I wanted to ask, you'll ask it now, Chris, is I noticed that there are quite a few property sales that are going through, but with the price not disclosed at the time of sale. And I'd be interested to get your observation on that. One of my hypotheses is if the price is actually lower than you might like to be able to admit to, you'd prefer to sort of keep quiet about the price that actually had to be paid. And of course, it's 2 months before the data gets through into the official statistics that way. I've got a lot of evidence of people actually having to settle at lower than the ideal settlement price.
Yeah, I think anything that's compromised right now, busy roads, dark, anything that's not a great asset, that's not super desirable right now, people are going to be patient. They're not going to say, I'm going to just buy that because I'm worried that if I come back in 6 months' time, that property is going to be more expensive. So 100%, anything that's like a B or a C or a D, anything in the apartment market, you know, I had a client yesterday, you know, it's not the greatest of properties, but he's worried that if he comes back in 6 to 12 months' time, he's not going to be able to sell it for as much as the offer is today. It's not a great offer, but by taking that offer, he's allowed to bank what he has got and then potentially go and buy another better property so he can upgrade in his family. And so 100%, I think that would be part of it. You know, I think it's always an option for the buyer and to kind of put up price undisclosed for a period, but you know, the agent might not want to let the other people know as well. So it's a whole game behind it. But yeah, it's not potentially always just because it's a lower price. There potentially is, you know, a bit of hiding the truth a little bit as well.
Right. And just going back to the repayment holidays, you know, if you do the maths, right, you know, there's let's say 400,000, give or take, you know, householders, right? We know maybe half would actually be in some difficulty, according to Morgan Stanley. So that's 200,000, right? So that means that there's something like 200,000 properties in some degree of discomfort. Now, not all of those are going to fall over. Not all of those will actually come on the market. So we're talking enough to make a difference to the market, but not enough probably to kill the whole market.
Yeah, so there's 10.5 million properties, right? So we're talking 200,000 out of 10.5 million. But demand and supply is very evenly, you know, ideally what the whole market's priced on is under supply and keep increasing demand. That's the Ponzi scheme of the property market. And that's why migration is so important. And that's why the government right now are trying to encourage first home buyers in with all these incentives, is because they've got to keep the demand going because supply is at risk. But some areas you're going to potentially see a lot more supply hit and very little demand. And so, yeah, those 200,000, if they are for investors with off the plan or they're in house and land packages areas, that without doubt will have a huge impact on the market. But if you, for example, break that down and say that that's in areas where there already is very low listings, you know, CoreLogic, for example, you know, you can just see their monthly report. It got released yesterday. You know, there's 160,000 listings in Australia right now. You know, generally for the last 5 years, there's been 200,000 listings, you know, so there's a lot smaller number of listings on the market. But, you know, and I guess in some suburbs, if you break it down, there's very little houses on the market on good streets Because right now, home buyers, upgraders, if you've got a good house on a good street, you're saying, look, especially with this Melbourne lockdown, it's freaked. People in Melbourne will be like, I'm going to sit on the fence. But say people in Sydney are going to go, is that going to happen here? Do I really want to run a campaign, pay for marketing, sell if there's another lockdown? And then do I want to be out of the market, then potentially having to buy? So most home buyers of good properties right now will just sit on their hands. Downsizers, you wouldn't go downsize now unless you had to. You would sit on your house because you know you're not going to get a great price, and then downsize to that apartment next year if you believe prices are going to be better. So listings are just going to dry up. It's what happened in March and April, and I think it'll happen again in Sydney. But you'll see the things that do come on are the investors are freaking out, and people who are distressed, like potentially in the outer areas.
Right, and it's interesting because that listing number from CoreLogic is quite a lot lower from the SQM one, or indeed from Domain, who seem to be actually saying that maybe listings are now higher.
Higher than last year?
Mm. Well, no, higher than a few months ago, I think.
Definitely higher than a few months ago. Like, yeah. It definitely took off. And that's after the April, listings really started to ramp up.
Yeah.
And actually much earlier, because usually it comes in at August, September, but they really started in the winter. There wasn't many sales in autumn. And I think the confidence had got back with people and didn't think a second wave was going to come here. And obviously it has. And I think that's going to really create another dip in listings where, you know, people are just going to sit on their hands again, if you can.
So I guess the key question then to think about, standing back slightly, is this property market going to remain relatively balanced, and therefore we're going to see maybe a little bit of adjustment down, but essentially nothing much? Or has the amount of debt that's been poured in over a long period of time and all the incentives that have been thrown effectively put the disequilibrium into play, and therefore are we actually looking at a bit of a Ponzi scheme?
I think the property market without doubt is a Ponzi scheme, because the reality is you need new entrants to keep on coming to buy, and that's the whole idea of the property market, right? So new entrants keep coming in, and keep paying people who want to. Any parties involved with it, the banks, the government, etc. And that's the whole system, right? And it's priced on that basis. But I guess that doesn't mean that it's going to end, you know, and so. I think I think this COVID situation is going to reprice things. It's going to basically say all the compromised stuff in the inner rings that were very expensive to live in premium suburbs, but not in great houses. I don't think they're going to be worth what they were worth prior to COVID, just because I don't think people are going to compromise because of the commute doesn't matter as much. I think, you know, all the apartments, the house and land packages, I think they're in for a lot of trouble just because of the economic impact. And I think that you'll start to see a bit of the wealth spread in terms of property. People will start going a bit further north in Sydney and south, et cetera. But the reality is so many people are so incentivized to keep the market going. I think you'll start to see potentially things like stamp duty change to land tax. You'll see more of these 5% deposit home loans, the building grants. You know, they'll argue that it really worked, so they'll keep on, you know, releasing more building grants. There'll be home builder version 2. Etc. So I think you'll find in 12 months time there'll be a massive disparity between how some areas and some properties perform versus, you know, good properties on good streets that suit young families that are in short supply will perform completely different to how these other properties will perform.
Right, and we always keep saying, and we should underscore again, you know, the market is not a market, it's multiple markets, and multiple markets often behave differently at different times because there are different supply and demand drivers, there are different numbers of people looking, there are different economic factors. I think it's probably even more tricky than normal, right, because I think people are going to find it quite difficult to try and pick where the places are going to be better. So what do you think the key warning signs are in terms of, locations and types of property?
I just think you've got to really target a property that hits as many demand buyer pools as possible and try to avoid properties that are targeting the affordable sort of place, but in areas where that are a bit more aspirational, because I mean, that's generally where you're going to find the income growth potentially a bit better. They're more established areas, they're in lifestyle areas that they're not areas that have been just getting built today. And those areas have got already a lot of properties that are paid off, et cetera, properties that have got very low debt. You're not going to start to see this sort of, and they can't really build any more properties in those areas, you know, avoiding the kind of new townhouses, the new apartments, et cetera. So you're protecting yourself from supply. And I just think you've just got to be really careful, even in those areas, just be careful buying the B's and C's and D's in those areas now, because they're very highly priced, because they were priced on the old world, which where commute was number one in the buyer preferences. Commute's not going to be number one, you know, if you don't have to go to the work 5 days a week in the city. So I think I'd potentially, if you're looking for a young family and you're thinking about, you know, what can you do, I'd avoid buying any of the new stuff, fringes, new house and land packages, etc. Buy more established areas. And if you're looking for potentially what's good value for money, I'd be buying in areas where the commute was discounting the price of that property before. So the one negative of that area would be the commute. So great place to live, great schools, great lifestyle, safe, good nature, but the commute was holding it back. You know, for example, your area, Martin, down sort of north of Wollongong, that's a cracking area where people, the commute was a big negative, right? Central Coast is another one,
yep.
Far northern beaches, southern highlands. You know, these areas are good places to raise families and, you know, still can get to the city, much more affordable than the inner ring, but the commute was holding them back. So I think if you can, you look at those. But a lot of people are buying where, you know, they are from, where their family are, etc. And so that'll keep the, you know, the demand in those same areas, because that's where people have grown up.
Mm. Well, just keep quiet about the air around here. We don't want too many people coming down. The lifestyle down here is remarkable insofar you can get access to the city if you need it, but you've got all the you know, the other delights of the beach and everything else in the local area. So that's the advert done. But you know, we don't want too many people down here. Shh, keep quiet. But I want to just touch on the off the plan stuff again, right? Because the government through Home Builder has been really, really pushing this. And for example, in WA, there was a massive rise in the number of people buying off the plan stuff because they could get $55,000 from the state and federal government combined. And my observation there was that, well, that's interesting, but if you look at the price they're having to pay in total for the thing they're moving into, you could buy cheaper existing in a relatively similar area. So in a way, what's happening is there's a big distortion because of the fact there are now all of these other land and house packages on the market. The price of land went through the roof at the same time, and people are being you know, sucked into those rather weird transactions. I just wonder whether it really makes any sense at all.
It really doesn't. And I think, you know, I've been banging on about this since, I don't know, 2012, 13. I've been talking about, like, the off the plan sector, how it works. I mean, the biggest risk, I mean, this 5% deposit scheme, I had this client this week and she's like, oh, I want to buy up in the Gold Coast and I want to buy in this new development. And I said, well, what do you want to live there for? And she says, oh, you know, I just really like the area and I really like that building. And it's the last, this is, I'm getting a lot of pressure from the developer because they're nearly sold out. She had all this anxiety built and I was kind of trying to slow her down and say, what are you trying to achieve here? You know, and you know, if you really want to be in that building, just rent in that building. And, you know, and she was a very small deposit. The conversation ended in a way that she's going to go out and do it anyway. She wasn't willing to listen to a potential alternative option, which was, if you really want to live in the Gold Coast, you really can only afford an apartment, buy one of those old red brick ones that are near the beach. You know, it's the same purchase price. Yes, it hasn't got a brand new Smeg oven that'll age really fast, but it's a much better investment if you really want it. That's the problem. People believe that, you know, the new property is better, and they never think, they go through that. What's the easy option today is going and signing that contract. The hard thing is when she goes to sell that property in 5 years' time, what's that? How's that going to affect her financial future? Not just her financial future, her future generally. You know, finance is a big part of it. So I think I just worry about everyone who's going through that process. And I just think that the state government, the federal government needs to take more ownership about really educating people around this. You know, they need it on one hand, but then they're on the other side, they're just pounding people to go and do it. And I just don't think it's great enough accountability, to be honest. And I think people know and they still do it. So it's very frustrating.
Well, I agree. And of course, this feds like Michael Zucker is always spruiking, you know, all of this stuff and saying how great it is for the you know, for people because they can afford to buy. But of course, this is all about, as we said earlier on, this is all about supporting the construction sector. And in a way, those prospective buyers are cannon fodder to help supporting the economy through the construction sector. But, you know, my observation is buying a new property at the moment is a bit like buying a new car. As soon as you drive it away, you basically have lost quite a lot, and you probably will never recover that.
If you're buying a new property, exactly, you're buying a very small fraction of the land at a very expensive price and a building that is like a new car, and it depreciates exactly like a car does. And you just have to look at buildings that are, say, 3 or 4 years old, and you look at it, and if someone told you it was 3 or 4 years old, you wouldn't believe it because it already looks 10, 15 years old. And business and the sort of what's like the funky sort of design materials, etc., you know, they change every year, and these buildings are just sort of aging, just and no one really wants that old building. Why would you, in 2 years' time, the buyer comes, says, I can buy the new one for the same price as the existing, I'll buy the new one because it's new, and all your demand. And so you just always get this flatlining of prices. But in Sydney, prices went up in 2015 just because there was such a huge influx of demand because of interest loans, foreign investors, the market just had to get involved, and it pushed, and people couldn't afford houses. So you had first home buyers and investors competing for apartments, which didn't really happen in Brisbane and Melbourne. And so Sydney's kind of the anomaly. The apartments really went up, the poor properties went up, but that I think just won't last forever because the investors aren't buying them now. First home buyers won't buy them. And so, yeah, that's your problem.
And of course, today, if you look at the listings, there are many, many thousands of investment properties and in fact, maybe even unoccupied properties in these high rises that were bought 2 to 5 years ago. And suddenly now they're all on the market at the same time. And basically there are thousands and thousands and thousands that look pretty much the same. And, you know, the old supply demand thing, they're just not going to hold their value. And then, of course, you've got the questions of construction quality and all those other issues as well. So, again, people, I think, are being quite cautious there as part of the story as well. So, in my data, I see a lot of examples of prices significantly down on where they were 2 or 3 years ago for that very reason.
Yeah, and the losses are mind-boggling. The bank doesn't use the money. Like, they are on occasion, but it's really the... It's the first home buyer that's got a 10% deposit. They've gone and got advice from anyone, buy any property, every property goes up, and they've gone in with a 90% loan. They've got to pay the agent to sell it. They've lost everything. They potentially have a debt at the end of it. It's not a pretty situation, and it's very hard to save your deposit and then to go and blow it just by not understanding what you're doing and the government encouraging you. I just think it's frightening, to be honest, and I won't stop creating noise around that because I actually just think that it's just not sinking in. And you know, I've got a good friend who's a depreciation sort of specialist, and he was telling me the other week, you know, still how many of the investors are still buying new stuff compared to existing, and so there's just it's not getting through. You know, people are still going out and falling for it, unfortunately.
Yeah, and of course, there are still spruikers in the mainstream media saying, you know, great time to buy, first-time buyers come in now, it's cheaper than it was, and housing is more affordable than it was, without actually really going through all of the issues. And it underscores the critical thing, Chris, isn't it, that people need to be quite analytical when it comes to thinking about buying property. And, you know, whilst there's an emotional commitment to doing it too, it really is important to think quite hard and make sure that the decisions that you're taking are sensible and balanced and make sense both from a financial perspective, but also from, if you like, a lifestyle perspective too. And those two things often pull in different directions.
Yeah, the lifestyle part's the huge part, and that's what I focus on. So, you know, what stage of life are you at? Where are you going to live long-term? How is your family potentially going to change? Are you going to have children? Are you going to have, you know, what's going to happen when the kids get bigger? Have you thought through your long-term lifestyle, you know, needs? And don't get to don't believe this kind of stepping stone. Like, do my parents bought in the outer suburbs, and I'll just keep upgrading and end up in Mossman. It just, it won't happen. So you need to get very realistic with what you're capable of achieving, and you know, buying a property that potentially you can live in long term and grow into. And then also then overlaying, making sure that yes, it's a place to live, but it's also a good investment, because at some point you will sell that property, whether it's retirement, whether you, your life plan changes because life's unpredictable and you, you do want to move to, you know, the, out the coast, or you want to swap cities or whatever it might be, and you go to sell that property, that's when it, it doesn't matter whether you lived in it or not. Now it matters if it was a good investment, and how that performs will then lead into the next decision. And it's a, it is a compounding, you know, thing. If that one performs well, then you've got more options for the next option, etc. So, you know, don't just buy a place to live in. You really need to think it's a place to live in long term, and then finally it has to be a good investment. And so if it wasn't a good investment, then why are you buying it? Like, you have to really be questioning it, and to be honest, don't buy it. So just be patient, you know, and when that good one does come along, you really know what you're doing, then just make sure you buy that one. So I think that's the problem with property. People just become far too impatient. They just buy whatever's on the market now. It's like looking for a job. If you're just looking for a job and the first job comes up, you take that. Is that the best thing for your career long term? Probably not. And so you have to take that sort of approach to property as well.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, those lessons are often hard learnt, unfortunately, but, you know, hopefully people following you and myself and other people will actually understand that there is a whole science behind making the property choice decision, and it isn't just something that you can do in a sort of a quick evening Google or, you know, a quick evening search of the website. We'll go for that one. Time and effort. Yeah. We'll save you money later, we'll give you a better outcome. And even in a falling market, and even a difficult market, you can still make good property decisions if you make them on the right basis.
Yeah, good property, because it's like there's not many properties that will come up, because the turnover rate on good properties is much lower than, you know, et cetera. And so even in the market right now, you can even see on the auction results last Saturday, there were some properties that went super hot and went for great prices just because, you know, it's on a great street, it's north facing, there's no privacy issues, it's a nice looking house, it's got better potential to add value to it, you know, and so those properties just don't come on that often. So even in, you know, when consumer sentiment is really low, unemployment's really high, etc., there's still demand, and there's still more than one person wanting it, creates competition, and it still sells for a good price. And so, you know, you have to do that. I set up a lot of pre-approvals for customers, and I either get, and there's lots of different types, but I get clients who will set the pre-approval up, which we did last week for a client, and on Saturday they've already seen two properties and they want to buy one. And I'm like, you know, it really worries me. I've got another one that literally sent me an email this morning, and I just don't think you've spent enough time getting enough reference points, really understanding the market, and they're out of area buyers trying to buy down towards Cronulla, and they don't know those areas that well. And, you know, and they just haven't spent enough time going through the market. They don't know whether they're good properties or not. And the, fortunately, when you try to rush it, you just buy the first thing that comes up. It's too late then. You signed your contract. There's no point looking at domain or real estate ever again, because you'll just frustrate yourself.
Yeah. Well, it's great advice, Chris, and particularly in the current environment. And, you know, we always say, I think, do the work, do the research, research again, keep researching, because ultimately that will end with a better outcome. I really appreciate your time. Thank you for sharing your thoughts with us. And I look forward to catching up with you again down the track when we'll know whether, in fact, the property is a lemon or whether it's something much more positive.
Yeah, 100%, Martin. I think, you know, what I like talking to you about is that you're very real in terms of looking at the data and understanding that, you know, there's lots that goes into it. It's not just the simple, you know, market's going to fall. Like, you back it with data. And I think what your listeners will always be also learning is that, you know, that there's many elements to the market. And unfortunately, I think when we come back in 12 months' time, it will be pretty horrible for lots of parts of the market. And I just think that that can't just keep kicking down the road. So if you have got a poor property right now, just at least accept that and then come up with a plan. And if you're trying to enter the market now, don't rush it, but do your due diligence and just buy a quality asset, and don't fall for any of the new property.
Great advice. Thanks very much, Chris. Talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Martin. Cheers.
Cheers.